This is The Spark. I'm Martha Woodruff. Terrific actor, writer, and now author, Ted Swartz has just published his first book. It's called Laughter is Sacred Space. The book and the show of the same name deal with Ted's own life and the loss of his longtime theater partner, Lee Eshelman, who killed himself in 2007. Ted Swartz, who grew up, he says, as a good little Mennonite boy, subtitled his book, The Not-So-Typical Journey of a Mennonite Actor. One disclaimer. I had the pleasure of auditioning once with Ted for a part in a show that I didn't get. But that didn't make the experience of being on stage with him at the audition any less great. So I want to talk about you as an actor, because I got the pleasure of being on stage at a tryout for 5 seconds. And experienced you as being one of the most present actors I've ever been on stage with. Where does that come from? From a little Mennonite boy? Am I allowed to say that?
Yes, I think you are allowed to say that. It has been said that that's the biggest trick of all for an actor, and is to be completely present in the moment. In fact, I've actually been doing some speaking outside of performing about what makes a good actor and relating it to actually what makes a good person, what makes a good person of faith with any faith tradition that you might have. And one of the things that I relate that to is that there's a theology of being present, which is what's important right now is the most important thing. We're not looking for something out in the future. We're not looking for a kingdom, quote, that's coming sometime. It's already come and we are here now. So all that to say that, yeah, it's the biggest trick of all. And I don't take it for granted. Although I suppose sometimes I do. Actors worry about so many things.
You have busy brain?
Well, they're busy brains in part because an actor has to worry about what they look like, how they sound. Am I connecting to this other person? Can I be heard? Can I be seen? And all of those things sort of wrap in. And one of the losses of all of that consternation that goes through actors' heads is, am I fully present? Not to make a joke out of it, but it's one of the things I think I inherited from my father, who was a meat cutter.
Tell me more.
Yes. I started working with my dad in 1960. He bought the store with my mom in 1966, and I started working in the early 70s. And then when I graduated from high school, worked for him for another 5 years. Got married in the middle of that and then moved away and then moved back. And then was a meat cutter with him until 1986. And it was a service meat market where you would come to the counter and order your meat, and it would be cut right in front of you. And so there was an interaction that happened with the customer that rarely happens anymore in that kind of setting. And Dad had a remarkable gift of making everyone feel like they were the most important person in the world at that moment.
Really focusing on them.
Focusing on them, yeah. The way that acting works best is if you can really tell that somebody's in conversation with someone else.
Yeah.
And we know when it's not there, but it's Stanislavski said many years ago that we're asking people to act naturally in an unnatural state, and that's what makes it hard. And
I want to go back to this audition. It's our one shared moment of time. I'm curious about what that audition was like from your side. It was an audition for
Lion and Winter.
Lion and Winter.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
You're going to be the star. You're going to be the king.
Right.
And you are up there reading opposite a number of different looking, different aged, different levels of talent women.
Mm-hmm.
Yet when I got up there, I didn't have any feeling at all that you were phoning it in. Were you faking it really well, or am I reading it correctly?
No, I remember it very well. I remember it very well. I could probably, in a lineup, pick out every woman that I read opposite against.
Yeah, and I'm not just talking about with me.
Right.
I thought with everybody. You changed with everybody and really interacted with everybody.
That's very nice of you to say.
Well, I don't say things to be nice.
That's good. Okay, well, let me step outside of my Mennonite background and my Mennonite inborn humility, which can be, I sometimes say that it's an anchor. A Mennonite background can be an anchor holding you fast to the community of support. It also can hold you fast to just hold you fast so you don't go anywhere. So it's one of the things that I do well. I'm in the middle of three kids. And my younger sister said, as I started working on the process of writing a book, she said, well, of course you were the favorite. Everybody knew that. And I said, why wasn't I told? I didn't know that. She said, well, everybody likes you. Everybody liked you when you were little. So there's this sense that you learn what it takes for people to like you. And obviously we all know what there's a downside to every piece of personality trait. So my biggest need, my sense of what do I really want in this moment, this scene, is I want to be connected to you. And some of it is born out of, I just want you to like me. And I will make, this sounds manipulative. It's not really, I don't think. I will make you like me by giving you my everything.
It sounds like being an interviewer.
There you go. I feel really good right now. You're doing this really remarkably well. I feel like I want to tell you everything.
Please do.
and then it's a matter of, there's a mystery to it. There's some things that, I think in some ways that it's an ability that you can learn, but rarely. You can learn to be better, but I think in some ways you either have it or you don't. My brother's a wonderful visual artist, and I understand what he's doing intellectually. I just can't do it. What he has is a freedom. When he tries to teach me something, and now I'm drawing on the desk in a radio interview, sorry.
Paint the picture.
And my previous partner was also a visual artist. So what both of them were able to do is to, without fear, and fear is the great constipator of creativity, is to let your hand move. Don't govern your hand. Don't let fear creep in and say, oh gosh, that's not right. It might be wrong. And then you stop and then you're sunk. My brother would talk about, your hand has to flow and the mind has to see what it is that you're doing, because your eye isn't helping you there at that point. That's a very mystical way to look at how drawing happens. And I think it's probably true. And I would say that I can do that in acting. I can't do it in drawing, in the art. So,
when did you say Mennonite boy? Because that I'm bouncing this conversation out of reading your book, Laughter is Sacred Space.
Yes.
And the not so typical journey of a Mennonite actor. So at what point did you say, I am an actor?
Oh, golly. I was in seminary. I'd gone back to school to go to college first at 30 years old. So I took an acting class because I thought it would be helpful in my pursuit beyond that into typical pastoral ministry. And started taking acting classes, fell in love with theater almost immediately. And
But why?
Why? Oh, that's a mystical question.
I'm a deep person.
Yes, you are. I would say that it felt so much like home. It felt like where I was supposed to be. Now, I was also a basketball coach for 6 years. I was a baseball coach for 8 years at different points in my life. And I thought at one point that's really where I needed to be. And maybe at 24, 25, 26 years old, when I started doing that, that's where I was supposed to be. But it didn't find a core the way that acting did. And it wasn't just about a performance. It just wasn't about, look at me. It was about the whole world of theater, the whole world of why we do it, even the technical aspects. I say in the book that I was volunteering to be making sound effects underneath the stage, which actors aren't supposed to do that, you know, generally, you know, on a general basis. So,
no props.
No, yeah. So I guess it was in pretty my mid-year in seminary, my second of 3 years in seminary, when I just realized, oh man, I'm in trouble here, because what I really was an actor. And anytime you declare yourself something, I mean, you either have, sometimes we're delusional about that. I've met some of those actors. Mm-hmm. But I think also that in any kind of art form like this, where there's so much doubt, fear, and your progress can be unmeasurable sometimes, that we are dependent upon other people to give us that kind of feedback. So people that you admire, people that you trust, people that are teaching you, if they're the ones that are saying, yes, this is who you are, this is what you should do, that really helps. It helps to justify what it is that you're feeling internally. And if I wouldn't have been told that I was good, I probably would not have continued to think I was an actor, if that makes sense. It's the internal, external way that we develop our identities.
How old were you when you said, I'm an actor?
35. Okay. 34, 35. Yeah, it's a great age.
Yeah. All right. Just swoop through Ted and Company. You know, this wonderful partnership.
Yes. I met Lee Eshelman in 1987, and it was a theatrical emergency. I needed a partner because somebody backed out on me. I was supposed to do some sketches, just comedy sketches, at a youth leaders retreat back up in, again, in the Mennonite community where I had been in Pennsylvania. And a guy called me on Monday and said, I've got a rehearsal on Saturday. I can't go. So I spent 2 days talking to everybody I knew who might actually have interest and ability. And as I say in the book, at about Wednesday night, I scrapped the whole ability and just went with interest. And then Joe Lapp, who was president of Eastern Mennonite University at the time, suggested, I just somewhat tongue-in-cheek asked him if he wanted to go. And I probably would have said yes at that point if he even said yes. But he suggested Lee, and I had never met him before, but I had seen him do a couple of comedy sketches earlier in the year. It's not necessarily my personality to walk into a room where I didn't know anyone or know that person and invite him to something like this. But I was really very desperate. And that was Wednesday, and I think I have the time frame. Wednesday night, he said yes. Thursday, we went through a quick rehearsal. I rewrote some things because he was going to take some of the roles that I was doing, having to do with comedic stage status. I mean, Lee played status very well, and I play lower status characters better. Lee had a very aristocratic, tall, he played that kind of character better, and I play dumb really well. It's a very innate skill. I'm just so happy I have it. Yeah, I put a hat on, and my IQ goes down about 40 points, just like that. So we met on Friday and or left on Friday, performed, and just it was a friendship that was kickstarted out of desperation and need. And as I think about it now, I'm not sure I've ever said it quite this way, that it was kickstarted around a lot of fear, desperation, and artistic discovery. And when that happens, it felt like we'd been together for a long time. Yeah. So it was, I'm not sure if this is going to work. We're going to trust each other and get out there and just go with that particular flow at the moment. And it was as if we had gained 3 years of friendship. And then for 5 years, while I was finishing school, we would do things every now and then. We went back to the same event a couple of times and then we do things on campus for our own church, a church retreat. There's some of my great memories because we'd be trying out stuff for the people there. And they have some wonderful memories of some of those beginning things.
That was your out of town.
Yeah. So 1992, when I graduated, we decided to take all of our material. We went to Barbara Graber, who was head of the theater department at EMU at the time. And we had started a theater company called Theater Akimbo together, Barbara and I did. And so under the auspices of that, she produced it. We hired another director, Bob Small, who was with Shannon Arts at the time, Stanton. And he came in and we had about 40 minutes of material I've gathered over the last number of years. And we said, let's put all our stuff together, see if we have a show. And then we improvised some material and then wrote scripts based on that. So Bob came in and we wrote about half the show afterwards. And then he directed us and we did our first comedy show in 1992 called...
Back after a break with more Ted Swartz. Back before the break, actor, writer, and now author Ted Swartz was telling us about the birth of his theatrical collaboration with the late Lee Eshelman, which they called Ted and Lee Live.
We had no idea it would become, you know, our last names, you know. And people still call me Lee because they know it's one of them. Or else it just gets mixed up in their heads. And that's the only reason I'm first in the name, Ted and Lee, because Ted and Lee Live was the alliterative. And then we just kept working at taking that comedy show, and for a couple of years, that's what we did. We took as much as we could out on the road, the connections that we had made, and then wrote three more shows in the ensuing years around biblical story. And that sort of became our niche, to take a scripture story and create theater out of that, starting with what's funny. And we always felt like the difference with what we were doing is that so much people have been writing comedy about those particular stories for a long time in some ways. But it always felt like the comedy was layered on top, that you were taking the easy answer or the easy way out rather than create a believable character who found themselves in humorous situations. It felt like it had a more organic and a more authentic theatrical piece. And we think that's what worked because
it did work.
We were desperate to stay away from cheesy church drama, which is just horrendous. And I think that Lee was with me as saying, we want to create a serious theater. We're not interested in writing skits. We're not interested in doing ministry. We wanted to do serious theater. It happened to be that our material had a sacred element to it, which allowed people to come to it with what they needed. But our first impulse was, as writers and performers, is if it's not good writing and not good theater, we're not interested in pursuing it. So a company has a purpose. What's the name of the? Thank God you're editing this. Mission statement. Our mission statement was.
Oh, I won't.
Thank you.
Every time I abadab, I leave it in.
Our mission statement was to make people laugh and do good theater. Period.
That's it. Nothing about the Bible or faith or anything.
No, at the time.
They're just good stories.
They were great stories. And as I look at Fish Eyes, which was the first full-length story we wrote that way, it was the first disciples of Jesus, and finding where the misunderstanding, the consternation, the absolute ridiculousness of what they were asked to do by following this person who was anything other than what they thought a Messiah was supposed to be. When people would call up and talk to our agent, they said, well, our themes for this are it's about a journey. Well, you want this show. Oh, our themes are about discipleship. Well, you want that show. Our themes are about faithfulness. Oh, that's the show you want. Our themes are about Jesus. Well, that's the show you want. It's like it was the show that fit absolutely everything because it's an arc of a human story with dilemma, with climax. The hero dies. I mean, it's got everything.
I want to go back to agent.
Yes.
You have an agent. Having an agent means somebody thinks you're marketable.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah. Otherwise, they're in a lot of trouble.
Yeah. Yeah. When did this happen?
Let's see. 1995, we hired someone to represent us.
Mm-hmm.
And then soon after that, we were full time, which means.
Which is astonishing.
Well, it's been wonderful. We found a niche, which is important, and we wrote our own material, which is also crucial. To find a niche, you probably have to create. I don't know if I was in class as a student or I assisted a class or two with Tom Arthur over at James Madison. Mm-hmm. And there was a guest in, Doug Mumall, who's a graduate of JMU. I think he's some local roots. He's also a fight choreographer. And an actor. He had a two-man show at the time. I don't know if he still does. I haven't talked to him in a while. And one of the things I've never forgotten, he says, if you want to do theater and do what you want to do, start your own company. He said, don't go join Disney where they tell you how to cut your hair. You know, that I remember that phrase. And it was really, really important to me to hear that, to say, you don't have to step into the existing genre, the existing structure, if you have the faith that your material is good enough and you can write.
What was your niche?
The niche was within a Christian market, quite honestly, a theater that didn't suck.
and was funny. Where were you performing?
It was pretty much split between, with those shows that were based on biblical stories, colleges, conferences, and churches.
Okay.
Lots of individual churches, especially before the economy died. Conferences, big events, 5, 6, 7, 10,000 people, where you're performing for the camera so it goes on screen. And then lots of colleges and universities as well. Pretty much split equally. And then some non-Christian circuits as well, still doing comedy. Our comedy show, we still love doing that and writing new sketch work for that.
So. Was this happy times?
During that?
Yeah, was this complicated times? Was it happy times?
That's a really good question. It was very complicated. But there's something so heady and wonderful, heady in the good sense of exhilaration, about discovering who you were as a person in the company of someone else who has similar ideas. Discovering comedy and making people laugh is just still one of the best things in the world. It's a combination of desperation between, if we're going to make a living at this, we have to do your marketing. If there's things you have to, prostitute isn't quite the right word, but.
Hustle.
You got to hustle. Yeah. You got to hustle. And that's hard because if you own your own company, there's a good chance you'll always get a role. So we don't deal with the normal rejection that most actors deal with. But if nobody books you, it's another level of rejection. So But yeah, there's some very, very happy times because each one of those steps of validation along a career path that is long and slow moving, but moving, it was much more preferable for us than flash in the pan. Oh, there's a big hit. See you later. And we used to talk about that. Would you rather have the big hit and then nobody remembers you, but that big hit will build your house? Or would you rather have a nice, long, slow, artistically fulfilling? And that's the other piece of it. To keep learning, to keep writing, to do something new, to do something different was important, especially for me. Lee and I had some differing philosophies about how much new stuff we should do. I was always interested in what was next and where that would take
us.
You
like the
work. Yeah, I did like the work of it. I have a love-hate relationship with writing, like many writers do. I sometimes feel like I'm right in that camp of, I forget who said it first, Stephen King, I know, said it at one point, that most writers love to have written. and sometimes I feel that way about it. And other times I think, man, this is where it's... another friend who's in a similar kind of position says, isn't this... This is amazing. We get to make shit up and people pay us for it. And that's kind of what the exhilaration of what it means to work in this particular field is. That line you agonized over, the line that flowed right out of your head and out of your mouth much more simply, there's really nothing quite like it. Someone is going to hear that, respond to it, have their own emotional reaction to it, either laugh, applaud, cry. I don't think I'm just a comic actor. That's my first impulse, is to make people laugh, because that's the quickest way to make people like me. But the silences that can happen when you've delivered a line in such a way that you know that they're hearing it the way that it's intended, or even better yet, they're hearing it in a way you didn't intend, and it's a surprise to you that they're hearing it in that way. Those silences are just remarkable. The new show that I have, Laughter, Sacred Space, that's based on my becoming an actor and my experience with Lee and his death, those silences are almost painful in some of those lines. But there's an exhilaration inside of you are thinking, okay, we, meaning you and the audience, have gotten that moment right.
Tell me about Lee.
Lee was brilliant. He was a consummate performer and a very good actor. He was a class clown. He was one of those kids that the teachers would need to sit on occasionally, partly because he was cracking the audience, or yeah, the class up, but them as well. He had one time where the teacher said, told his mother, he needs to stop it because I can't stop laughing. He was graduated from college already by the time I got to college, even though he was 7 years younger. So our relationship had an interesting dynamic in that he was much more learned, much more educated. He was a 4.0 college graduate, and I learn only if I'm fully acclimated to the moment. Being present once again. If I'm not present, I'm easily distracted, and then I struggle academically. Similar backgrounds in some ways, but his parents were professionals. My dad was a 10th grade education, so a bit more rural. I was in terms of where some of our understandings. Both graduates of Mennonite high schools, which is a commonality. About 2 years into our relationship, we started to see evidences of a deeper depression than what we had just discovered initially, and was diagnosed as a bipolar illness with a clinical depression. And that became the other, I call it the elephant, or at least the large land-based mammal in the room, mm-hmm. which is what it is for so many people who struggle with that particular illness. And wasn't sure if this is what he wanted to do. This whole business of, it was fun to do, but it started this relationship where I felt like I needed to constantly convince him of something. To pull him along, mm-hmm. to say that we should be doing this. Not only am I good enough, you are. And
it
he was
became
at...
became a kind of a high-maintenance relationship?
In some ways. Not always. But in some ways, yes. But I don't want to typify it as you know, there was constant drama, because there wasn't, or constant conflict, which there wasn't. We just absolutely loved time on stage together. You know, no matter what happened, there was going to be a time we were going to be on stage together. Now, you're always in competition, and that's a good thing. I remember some of the teachers that I had early on were saying, or then I began teaching it as well, is you want the audience to be looking at you. Now, you need to share when it's time to share, and then when you need to take it, you need to take it. You need to be the most interesting thing on stage. Not upstaging, but when it's your turn, you got to be ready. And so we tried to write and also perform in such a ways that we gave each other the floor every now and then. Neither one of us was the straight man for the other.
And you did this deliberately.
Yeah, we did it deliberately.
Yeah.
We would say, okay, that's a Lee moment. Okay. He will take that one, and then he'll give it back to me, or vice versa. And the times that we had the most conflict on stage, we talk about it later, is that when we one or the other would feel like sharing wasn't happening in the way that we had agreed. Because you'd get a moment, you know, everybody gets a little full of themselves, and you say, well, I can stretch that moment a little bit more, or I could have the final line, or, and that's not fair. So, plus we worked really, really hard at the writing, and if you didn't follow the writing, you always want to be open to an improv moment, but if it took you off base, yeah, basically what you're doing is you're not respecting your own work, which is the writing, and we really worked hard at that. So, Lee went into the hospital here in Rockingham late 1990, and then was hospitalized in Rockville, Maryland for a number of months, and then was an outpatient for several years under care up there. Worked as a waiter on the off days that we weren't on the road before we went full time.
So he was really had become quite fragile, I guess you would say.
Well, in some ways, but you know, I don't want to typify it as somebody I had to carry or take care of.
Yeah.
No, I don't think that's quite the right word.
All right.
But it had to be there. And obviously there was growth. I mean, he dealt with it for 20 years or so.
And throughout all of this, on stage was still cooking.
Yeah. Yeah. We were writing new works all the time. Toward the last 4 or 5 years of our relationship, he was writing much less. So I was doing most of the writing. But on stage, no. I mean, it's fun because he was such a big presence. He was 6'4" and blonde and handsome and had a great voice, and he was a better singer than me. I think, I don't know this for sure, but it seems to me that in a setting where we would walk into a room or see us on stage for the first time, that people's eyes would go to him first.
He was the babe.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And he's blonde and all those attributes that sometimes capture your eye. And he was gregarious, especially when the illness didn't grab him. And so it was pretty well hid from people, the illness and the issues, because you just don't expect that the person who made you laugh so hard or made you feel good about life or connected you in a way to something you hold precious and didn't know was there could struggle with that. It was just a great paradox.
How did you feel about Guy and your relationship with him over this arc of 20 years? Is he really became... ill or had depression to deal with?
It's interesting because the last number of months, last number of weeks, as the book came out, and I've done now the new show seven times, and you know we're aggressively marketing and pursuing places to perform and to talk about and hope the book does well and on all those things that is pushing me along the way toward my own issues of healing and growth to dealing with stuff that. I think I'm a classic case of, well, if I just keep moving fast enough, all this other crap won't catch up to me. And in some ways, this project, both the show and the book, is a culmination of that 5-year scramble of if I just keep in front of it, that cloud that's behind me won't come up and swallow my ass.
And now the cloud's there?
Well, I think I'm ready to actually think about it a bit more and say, okay, I sort of knew that's what I was doing. So I'm able to, I think I'm maybe being forced or I'm slowing down enough to say, I need to really look at some of these, of what does it mean to love someone to an extent, in the way that we did, and then deal with the guilt and the anger that goes along with when someone takes their life, the anger that he did it, the anger that it puts you in a situation, that you're in, knowing that the illness is speaking louder than anything else at that moment in his life, but also dealing with the guilt of not only did you do enough, but did you have a hand in making him who he was. I think that's much more greater. And then I actually started adding some lines in the show that have to do with it. The line is something like, I made the brilliant decision. First of all, I should say that early in the paragraph, I said that mourning, I've been told, is an action. You decide to mourn. It should be a conscious decision. Grief is different. Grief just happens. You don't know when it's going to show up. And I made the brilliant decision not to mourn and to fight grief. Problem is you can't fight something you don't know when it's going to show or what form it will take. So the first thing you do is you deny its existence. So you're really not grieving. And the way that you do that is you convince yourself it didn't matter that much. Or you convince yourself that your feelings for someone weren't that deep
Let's stop for 1 second because there are going to be people listening who don't know what happened.
Okay.
So what happened?
Okay. 2007, Lee took his life that afternoon, May 17th.
And it was no casual gesture mishap.
No. It was a definitive action. And Lee had such difficulty making decisions that it probably in some ways felt good to make a decision. I don't know that I've said that very often out loud.
Ted Swartz keeps talking after a break. This is The Spark. I'm Martha Woodruff. Just before the break, actor, writer, and now author Ted Swartz, whose book and latest show are both called Laughter is Sacred Space, told us that his longtime theater partner and friend, Lee Eshelman, killed himself on May 17th, 2007.
We had set up for a show. That morning, we were to perform the next night. And so that irony, every time I do that line in the show, I think it's become deeper for me because I'm hearing someone hearing that, and it's a part of my life, but I'm hearing that irony and paradox in different ways each night I do it, that we set up to do the one thing that was a respite for both of us, which is to perform that morning. So
you've been an actor for decades. This thing happens.
Yeah.
This long relationship happens. It's a long, complicated relationship mm-hmm. that has love in it.
Yeah.
Out of it comes a book. How'd the book idea come about?
I was actually asked to consider writing a book, in part because...
By God?
Well, that's a really interesting question. She was very attractive. God was in this case. The young woman who was in charge of the publishing house. And there was a book... It came out a couple of years ago called Mennonite in the Little Black Dress, which was hit the New York Times bestseller list and was it's very funny and well-written and irritated a lot of people.
In the Mennonite community?
In her community on the West Coast, including family.
Okay.
Not my family, her family. And it seemed to misrepresent the broader Mennonite community because it was Mennonite Brethren, and it made assumptions that everyone would think that this is what a Mennonite was. And it's... You know, it's not East Coast, it's not Swiss German, it's not the Mennonite Church, it's the Mennonite Brethren, which is subtle differences.
Yeah.
But they're really important for people inside of it because how we define ourselves and all of those things are sometimes good and sometimes annoying as heck. So she said, we'd like a Mennonite who's still a Mennonite to write a book that's funny that will allow their parents to go out in public. That was the wording that she used because this particular person is no longer a part of that community. And I have my own issues with people who write from that perspective and still claim a Mennoniteism because I don't particularly think it's an ethnic delineation. Some people do. I don't. You make a decision to join this particular faith community, you are. If you choose not to, for many, many reasons, they may be viable reasons to leave the community, you no longer are. You get to be a beloved child of God. You get to be everything you are, but...
You're not a Mennonite.
Well, no. Yeah. I mean, it's just... It's a little bit like saying, I'm a member of this football team. Now, I'm going to get a lot of calls about that one. But anyway, let's not go too far. But I said to her, I said, I think I could write a book. I had never written a book. I can write stage. So then the switch to stage to prose in a way that I think I could still do that. But if I write a book, it's not all going to be funny. And she said, that's okay. You write what you want.
How'd she know about you?
As a member of the Mennonite community, okay. Not everybody does, but... Lots.
But
it's a high profile. It's a small pond. So she knew who I was and knew Lee's story and all of those kinds of things. And she's young enough that she probably went to a convention when she was in high school.
And saw you.
Probably yeah. So.
Laughed her head off.
There you go. I would be hope so. So the book came out of that. And I was unsure that I wanted to do it.
Did you sign a contract saying you would?
Well, not right away. I started asking some friends, and I had some people say, you know what, people don't get asked to write books very often. You'd be stupid not to do this. And if someone...
As a career move or stupid how?
It would be... Yeah, maybe. Or just the idea that it's a pretty rare thing, and if you even think you have any ability to do it, you should do it, because that would mean that they are already committed to you as an author, if they're going to ask you to do it, they're going to do everything in their power to make it as good as possible.
Do you have any hesitation as a guy who was racing ahead of grief and mourning that you were going to be delving into what you were racing ahead of?
I didn't think about that as much, and I'm hopefully I can articulate this well, that there's a little wall that many actors and writers, I think, put up. It's not a high wall, but it's a little wall that allows you to function and work in and delve in hard personal stuff. So I put my wall up in much the same way I did when I gave a eulogy at Lee's funeral, is that people would comment about how hard that must have been. I said, and I didn't say, well, no, I was just doing my actor thing. Now thinking about it and writing it was difficult, but then you get into, okay, that phrase is work. That allows me to say what I really want to say about him in the most artistic, clean, funny way. And it was, I don't want to diminish the difficulty of dipping inside of yourself in any subject matter, but it felt a little bit like I was wanting to write the best art as I could,
yeah,
as an art form. And so you use what you know best to do that. And it's when I go back and stop and actually read some of my own stuff later that I will allow it for that cloud to catch up a little bit in the metaphor that I'm using. I don't want to diminish the vulnerability of the book if, in fact, it's there. But
it is.
There are well, good. But there are times when you throw a switch up, and otherwise you don't get out of bed in the morning. Those things pop up for me when I leave it with my own personal stuff. It's well, I say it in the book too, that we have a mutual friend who said, I'm just jealous of two people who have that many inside jokes. And it was just a line. Something just came up recently again that I don't get to do. I don't get to do some of my favorite bits. And I don't mean stage stuff. I mean stuff that happened just because we were so close and spent so much time together. This is something that I forgot to put it in the book, actually. If you've seen the movie, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Oh, yeah.
Well, the one guy gets recaptured in the film, and they're in a movie theater. And it's dark. And the one guy who has not yet been captured hears this voice that says, do not seek the treasure. And they had taken all the convicts to see the movie. They were all linked together. But these two guys who had escaped find themselves, interestingly enough, in the same theater. They don't want to get caught. So they're all looking for this treasure. And he said, do not seek the treasure. So I don't know how many weeks later, I'm in a restroom in an airport in the stall, sitting, contemplating life. And I heard someone come in next to me. And when that happens in any kind of public, there's a little bit of a tension, like, okay, now there's two of us in here. What kind of noises are we making here? You know, those kinds of things. Oh, I don't want to be. So there's, you know, they sit to contemplate life. And then I hear this rustle, and this piece of paper comes sliding underneath the stall. Like, oh my gosh, I'm being solicited. Oh, I don't know what to do with this. And I look at it, and it's a bank envelope, and it says, do not seek the treasure. I nearly peed myself. Well, it was a good, I laughed so hard.
That was Lee.
Yeah. It was Lee beside me. And he knew I was in there, and he was just, and so.
You don't have a steady partner anymore. So what's happened to you, the actor, you the writer?
I think what I did is moving as fast as I could to stay ahead of this cloud of grief. I read eight shows in 2 years.
Wow.
And then I wrote two more in the next year. So I wrote 10 shows in 3 years.
That's like Roadrunner.
Yeah, exactly. So what it was, and each one of those, not all of them, but I would have different partners and a couple of instances, different writing partners. So Ingrid DeSanctis and I wrote a show that first year. She's a local playwright and performer, a wonderful performer. She and I wrote a show together, and then I wrote another show called Excellent Trouble with another writer and performer. And then Trent Wagler and I wrote two shows together in 2008, and then put another one together in 2009, where Trent was writing original music for it, and it was some really, really wonderful, wonderful time. So it's not as if I was not wanting to work with people in general. And those people that were working with me in those early years were just saints, because I, you know, I was flailing around a lot. But I think we did some great work. I wrote some of my best stuff in those years, which is not surprising for how we know art works and where it has its roots and where it comes from. I've been doing more solo work. That's something I really resisted for a long time, because I really feel like the root of the most fun acting is in listening and responding to each other and working off of each other. And so to find the audience as partner when you're doing more monologue work, it was a little bit more getting used to. And I think I'm also getting more comfortable with when you're a duo, you can hide behind that. You can, you know, you don't have to have all the attention. And while us actors and performers like attention, there's sometimes you just want to, you don't want it. You got to go away.
And then we could stare at the wall for a while.
Yeah. So we're duos, you know, or, you know, Lee could take the lead on being the person that talks to the first, you know, the sponsoring group, or be, you go to a party and you just want to go hide in a corner somewhere, then he can, you know, but I'm getting a little better at saying, okay, well, this is me, this is who I am. And I don't have to be, you know, one half of something. And it's been a growth part period for me in that of, and that's okay. I don't like to travel by myself, so that gets old pretty fast.
So. How are you feeling about Lee?
Oh, that's a big question.
I know.
Somebody asked me a couple of weeks ago, and this is part of what I think is my is that metaphor work, allowing the cloud to catch up?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so part of that process for me is a couple of weeks ago, someone asked me at a party, and I can't remember what the question was, and I was in the process of trying to discern some big decisions about, do I do more speaking around some of the issues of grief and theater and art, coupled with some theatrical moments within it, or do I just do a show? And it's a kind of a marketing decision. It's becoming, quote, a personality as opposed to just being an actor doing a show. And that's a big step to admit that. So anyway, she was asking me, she said, well, what does Lee say with this sense that she's a bit of a mystic and saying that there's things that we don't understand, and sometimes there's spirits of people that continue to inform us, speak us, guide us, comfort us, those kinds of things. And I said, quite honestly, I guess one of the things I would say is Lee gave up his right to talk to me when he left, and to embrace maybe a different way of looking at that is an interesting idea. So how do I feel about Lee? And coupled with that, a woman came up to me over a weekend show, after a show, and said that she had a message for me. So, and it was, I don't think I need to say all of it, but it was a comfort to say, for me to hear something. If she said, please don't think I'm nuts. And, you know, it's not in my worldview, but I'm much more open to that than I had been in the past, because there's so much that we don't know. So, she said that he is with me and there's nothing I could have done. And for me to feel and hear that, I think is part of a process to begin looking again. How do I really feel about it? Because we are motivated to accomplish things in many ways. Anger is a motivation, but it burns itself out pretty quick. And I don't, it's still complicated, my relationship with Lee. And I think I still struggle with the sense of still, still negating that grief by denying at some really deep level what it really meant.
You miss him?
Oh God, yeah. Nobody else knows the story as well as he does, or at least a huge piece of it. I mean, nobody made me laugh more, and that's no small thing. and nobody understood comedy the way he did, in the way that we worked together. Even when I was doing most of the writing, I would write for him, knowing that he would take it and understand immediately what he was supposed to do with it and make it better. Nobody else does that.
Dedication, devotion, turning all the nighttime into the day. And after all the violence and double talk, it's just a song and all the trouble and the strife. You do the walk, yeah, you do the walk of life. You do the walk of life.
You'll find a link to Ted and Company Theater Works on the Spark page at WMRA.org. And now, Harrisonburg writer Chris Edwards reviews Ted Swartz's memoir, Laughter is Sacred Space, The Not-So-Typical Journey of a Mennonite Actor.
secular, sophisticated comedy fans, folks who loved Monty Python, may have hurried past entrances to the Ted and Lee shows, once learning of their biblical themes and main clientele. Church groups? What they missed was laugh-out-loud funny, as the mere scripts scattered through Ted Schwartz's new memoir can be. Ted, surviving member of that 20-year duo with the late Lee Eshelman, praises Python's commitment to silliness, ironically, the very trait for which a few unhappy Christians, whose letters he's dutifully reproduced in his book, denounced Ted and Lee as ungodly. In Laughter is Sacred Space, Ted shares moments of and stories behind such characters as the rustic prophet Jeremiah, whom God forbid to wash his underwear, and homeless, spaced-out Zeus, who explains the Book of Revelation. Subtitling his book, The Not-So-Typical Journey of a Mennonite Actor, Ted riotously but affectionately sends up his heritage. When his father adopted modern clothing, a fellow churchman told him, "You are going down." Ted recalls, "We assumed down meant hell. He wasn't going to deck, Dad. Mennonites didn't hit anyone." Seeing baseball, his grandmother, pictured on the cover, asked, "Why does he pitch it so the other fella can't hit it?" Ted confesses to squirming early in his stage career when required to kiss an actress, having only kissed one woman before, Sue, his sweetheart since high school, and wife. They moved to Harrisonburg so he could study for ministry, but theater became his calling. He's bemused by some observations on the road, having never cursed, smoked, or used drugs, but totally devoid of piousness. In his book, Ted mines life on tour, rattletrap van, injuries, production gaffes, for comic lore. Soon he and Lee, each raising families in Harrisonburg, got to quit their day jobs. But then, 5 years ago, Lee, whose whimsical cartoon illustrations graced the book, killed himself. From that point, despite its intentionally classic structure, the narrative, like Ted's life, feels choppy. On top of grief, he found himself in debt, his career at loose ends. The last pages remind me of C.S. Lewis's A Grief Observed, rage at an absent God, followed by a life affirmation the author doesn't try to explain. Ted only shows us on the cover that he began with the title Laughter in Sacred Space, but replaced in with is.
Chris Edwards lives and writes in Harrisonburg. The Spark is a joint production of the WMRA Land Community and the staff of WMRA Public Radio. The Spark theme music is supplied by the Avant-Gardeners of Albemarle County. Terry Ward is our web wrangler. Thanks to Matt Bingay for turning over his galley of Ted Schwartz's book to me. So whom do you know I should talk to? Please, don't be shy. Send me your suggestions through the Spark page at WMRA.org. I'm Martha Woodruff. It has been a great pleasure to be with you.